They did that on healthcare. It's mystifying to me why they haven't done that on every other program. And the only thing I can conclude is that because they want to play politics, because they have demonstrated that when they do want to work collaboratively with us, they will. So they're making the choices of when they do and when they don't. And they're doing it in our areas of jurisdiction. I don't do that to them. They shouldn't be doing it to me.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Welcome aboard. Rob Breckenridge with you. Afternoons on QR Calgary on a busy Thursday afternoon. That was Premier Danielle Smith yesterday in the unveiling of the Provincial Priorities Act, Bill 18, which seeks to involve the province then when the federal government wishes to strike a deal with a municipality or for that matter, any other entity under provincial jurisdiction. We've seen a flurry of announcements as of late between the federal government and various municipalities, notably Calgary and Edmonton, when it comes to infrastructure funding, compared to the deals the feds have struck with the province of Quebec, the province of BC. So the Alberta government is now saying that's how it has to be. An agreement that involves the province of Alberta, or at least a deal that has Alberta's approval. So why is this necessary? What does this mean? What kind of deals are we talking about? How far does this go? Joining us for an overview, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Alberta's Minister of Municipal Affairs, Rick McIver, joins us this afternoon. Minister, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Rob. Thanks so much.
So let's start with the need for this. I mean, how is Alberta being harmed, I guess, by the status quo, the absence of such a law?
Well, we're getting a raw deal, really, on a whole number of fronts with the federal government. Just time short, so I'll cut to the chase here. Three or four weeks ago, a federal minister dropped into Alberta and dropped and made a $175 million pledge for housing, which is nice, and we appreciate that. But Alberta's about the same population as BC, and the very next day, they went to British Columbia and offered $2 billion. So we're getting somewhere between half and a fifth of what we should be getting based on what other provinces get across the country on situation after situation after situation. And we just can't sit back and let that happen. So we're doing what the premier and our government got elected to do, is to defend Albertans' interests, and make sure all Albertans, including Alberta municipalities, get their fair share of funding from the federal government as compared to other provinces.
So the argument that, so I understand it, so that we have received insufficient funding, this approach will, you think, yield more funding?
Well, we just want fair funding, Rob. It may still be insufficient, but we want the same amount of insufficient funding as the other provinces get. We keep getting shortchanged when you do a comparison. So we're not going to sit by quietly. We're going to enforce our legitimate authority under the Constitution. Quebec, for a long time, when the feds come out with a new program, they take the money and don't have to follow the feds' rules and their ideological bent to one way or another. And we think, well, why complain about Quebec? We're just going to try to do the smart things that they do and try to have Albertans benefit in the same way that the people of Quebec benefit. And we're trying to learn from those that are successful.
Well, explain how you think this will result in more money coming to Alberta.
Well, it works for Quebec. That alone is an argument that it could work here. There's no guarantee that the federal government currently seems hostile towards Alberta, but we want to put ourselves in the best position, particularly if we end up going to court to say that we are not being treated in the Federation, and that needs to stop. But further than that, it goes beyond that. They have ideological bents that may be at odds with Alberta's priorities. For example, I don't know what's in the housing deals that I will soon learn, but I don't know yet what's in the housing deals that the feds made with Calgary and Edmonton. But in the deal that they made with Kelowna, as I understand it, they've agreed to not hook up any homes after 2030 with natural gas in Kelowna. And we'll never agree to that in Alberta. Our energy industry is the most successful and the biggest contributor, I think, to the Canadian economy, and certainly the biggest in Alberta. And we're not going to let the federal government walk in and tell us to cripple our biggest industry.
No, we don't have to. And I think people would be sympathetic to that position. But I mean, here's the thing. If it's true, and maybe it is, that, you know, that the feds are going to attach strings to funding that serve their agenda, or even if it's true, and maybe it is, that the federal government is hostile toward Alberta. I mean, if both of those things are true, it seems unlikely, though, that this kind of approach is going to yield any more money. If anything, you know, that the feds might pull back on funding.
Well, we're pulling back on funding, Rob. That's the problem. It's not like they're pulling back a little bit. They're pulling back a lot. So we can sit here and say nothing, or we can actually do what we were elected to do, is stand up for Albertans, defend them, and try to make a difference. And that's exactly what this premier and this government's doing.
I mean, is there a concern? And look, I think it would be fair to blame Ottawa if that's the case, but is there a concern here that, the feds just simply say, we'll just spend that money elsewhere?
Yeah, that's always a concern. But they're already spending the money elsewhere. Rob, we've hardly got anything to lose. It'll be really hard to go backwards from here. There's really only one direction we can go compared to other provinces, is it's forward, and we are determined to go forward. That's what Albertans elected us for. That's what they expect of us. It's what we promised. And by golly, that's what we're doing.
Right. Well, and again, I mean, it's not nothing. I mean, obviously, the governments, or the municipal governments in Edmonton and Calgary, seem happy with these deals. I mean, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say that the mayor of Calgary and Edmonton have one municipality they're responsible for. I have 330. And at least at this point, 320 of them are getting nothing. And those are my responsibility and our government's responsibility, too. And we have to look after all of Alberta. We love Calgary and Edmonton, but it's not, we love every place else too, and we can't sit by quietly. Well, as of today at least, the 320 out of 300 municipalities are getting zero and may well end up getting zero at the end of the day, and maybe with conditions from the federal government that the federal government has no constitutional authority to put on any municipality, and they're doing it. So we wouldn't be doing our job well if we didn't actually look after our authority and take the responsibility for administering the rules that those municipalities operate under, and fight for money for them in fairness and equal comparison to what other provinces get. And we're doing our job, and we're happy and proud to do so.
So, I mean, if it went this way, that we received a lump sum from Ottawa through the province, and that would then go to municipalities, is the commitment here that would be distributed on a per capita basis to municipalities?
We would look at the need. Our commitment to Calgary and Edmonton is we will try to honor the deal that they've already made with the federal government, and we're hopeful that we can honor the complete deal. But if they have conditions in there about no more natural gas after some date or another, we're obviously not going to support that. But our hope is not, the whole goal is never to hurt Edmonton and Calgary, but rather to get fair treatment for everybody else.
Well, but that's what I mean. I mean, you accuse the federal government of not distributing these funds on a per capita basis, which is a fair criticism, but doesn't that apply to your government? If you believe that per capita funding is the fairest way to do this, wouldn't you commit to doing that in distributing these funds?
No, and you know what? We have formulas that we distribute our major funding to the municipalities, formulas that they have agreed to, and that's one of our choices, is to distribute the money with a formula that the municipalities have agreed to. But whether we do that or not, here's the difference. We get the same share of money with the federal government by population. That is our business. How we distribute it to the municipalities is none of the federal government's business. And we need to keep that in mind. All of this is our business. It's not the feds. And they are intentionally and obviously intruding on our sole jurisdiction. And that has to stop.
I mean, there are federal dollars that go to cities. And, we've got examples recently with housing announcements that you're obviously referring to. But just in terms of the scope of this legislation, are we talking about any kind of deal at all involving municipalities, and for that matter, universities? Or is it only certain kinds of deals? Do we know yet?
Yeah, no, it's all deals, but for my ministry in municipal affairs, what we think we've learned, because we've asked the municipalities how many arrangements they have with the federal government, is if my numbers are accurate, it's 64 agreements with Calgary, 44 with Edmonton, and the rest of the municipalities across Alberta, it averages somewhere between 5 and 8 agreements per municipality.
So is this going to mean then your department, or maybe a different department, having to kind of constantly be reviewing the deals or possible deals that come across, whether it fits into this legislation, and who's taking the lead on that?
Well, the premier is the intergovernmental relations minister. I will, I'm sure she'll put me on the, already has really put me on the, everything that has to do with municipalities. We have an advanced education minister to deal with the universities. We have a health minister to deal with the hospitals and the schools. listen, we work cooperatively with the federal government whenever they give us a chance. It seems that we just recently signed a health funding agreement with the federal government and the other provinces where Alberta got fair treatment. That's all we want. You know what? People complain about us fighting. I agree, but the federal government starts these fights because they just don't treat us fairly. We just want to be treated the same as all other provinces. Using Quebec as the gold standard to get fair treatment all the time, we say, well, let's do what they do. Let's try to get the best fair deal for Albertans. We don't want more than our share. We want to be full contributors to Canada, but we're not doing our job if we let Alberta municipalities, Alberta citizens, suffer for somewhere between 20% and 50% of what everybody else in Canada gets. That isn't fair. It isn't right. And we won't sit quietly by while it happens.
Just in closing, and it sounds like this won't actually take effect until next year. In the meantime, I think the feds are still in this period of just a flurry of announcements. So what's going to happen in the meantime?
We will pass the legislation. And then when the feds want to walk in here and impose their will on a municipality, they won't be able to.
Right. But I mean, this period before this is law, before this passes.
Yeah, well, we'll have to hustle. Okay. We can't change the past, but we can surely change the future. And it's our responsibility and what we were elected to do. And we are committed to do it. And I think we're taking action on that commitment.
All right. We'll watch with interest. Minister, appreciate you making some time for us here today.
Rob, I really appreciate this opportunity. Thanks so much.
Welcome back. So we heard from the minister. I want to talk a bit more about what might be involved in this. What are going to be the practical realities of the Provincial Priorities Act? Our next guest says, look, there's a lot of merit to the idea of provinces being more involved. They also need to be realistic about what's going to be required of them now. Dr. Jared Wesley is a professor of political science at the University of Alberta. He joins us on the line here this afternoon. Dr. Wesley, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So we knew this was coming, so not a surprise that the Alberta government has gone down this path. But were you surprised by anything that was announced or included in this yesterday, first of all?
Well, I think the scope of it was definitely not what we expected, but that seems to be par for the course here for the UCP government. I know when it came to the trans rights legislation that they foreshadowed, they went further than everybody expected using the Saskatchewan and New Brunswick model there. And in this case, they went further than what the government of Quebec is currently doing by not only asking that all agreements between municipalities and the federal government be brought under this legislation, but also all public bodies, including school boards, universities, and others. So, that was a bit of a surprise.
There's clearly some high-level politics here, you know, under the Fair Deal umbrella, or you know, sort of the Alberta versus Ottawa dynamic that we've been getting used to here, but. The idea, though, in principle, that, you know, dealings between, even if we want to just focus on municipalities, between Ottawa and municipalities, that there maybe should be, there's something to be said for some provincial involvement here. What do you make of the underlying principles of all of this?
Yeah, well, and I'm the first one to disclose my bias here. I mean, I worked in intergovernmental relations for the province of Alberta for 5 years, five premiers. It was a busy time. and I saw the value, honestly, of a coordinated approach to intergovernmental relations in general, but agreements in particular. And having an internal shop go through all of the different intergovernmental agreements within the GOA, right, all the various ministries, was quite helpful in helping to ensure that there wasn't any particular clauses in these agreements that would subject Alberta to, you know, upholding federal legislation be in other cases unconstitutional. So in that sense, it's quite helpful. But there that function of government really depends on these ministries' ability to execute these agreements with the staff that they have on hand. So the capacity question is a big one here. Does the GOA have enough staff on hand to vet all of these agreements that are going to be coming through the Premier's office?
Well, that'll be the rub here, right? I mean, whether, you know, the resources are devoted to addressing all of that, I think, you know, you get dueling perspectives. The Premier says, you know, dealing with just one entity, that being the province, as opposed to a bunch of municipalities or other organizations or entities, that could be more efficient. Critics are saying, you know, with just more involvement, that's more red tape. I mean, where do you come down on that?
Yeah, well, I think that the Minister McIver in particular maybe downplayed the amount of work that needs to go into this process. I mean, they've signaled that they're open to exempting a bunch of different types of agreements from these, from this process. One would imagine that would include like student scholarships or research funds or something like that that are pretty routine. They probably wouldn't want to look at that. But the very determination of what constitutes a major agreement, that itself takes time to determine, right? So they estimated, and I don't know where they pulled this estimate from, somewhere around 14,000 agreements in a year that they need to deal with.
Wow.
Somebody's going to have to narrow that down to the 800 that they see as being problematic. And 800 is a ton of agreements to go through. When I was there, we would manage about 400 a year. So that's already double the number of agreements that were going through the shop about 5 years ago. And that's just a massive upstaffing and training. And it's not going to catch all of the agreements that are out there either.
Right. So, I mean, is it clear what this bill is aimed at, first of all, the kind of agreements, or would it be any sort of agreement between the federal government and a provincial entity?
Well, this is where I'm optimistic. The government has said that they're going to spend the summer engaging with the various stakeholders in these public bodies to figure out what kinds of intergovernmental agreements are out there with the federal government. And I think through that process, they're going to have their eyes open. And quite frankly, a lot of public bodies are going to have their eyes open, including municipalities, universities. They're not going to know just how many agreements they have on the go with Ottawa. So in that sense, I think it's positive. But through that process, they're going to see just how much of a logistical nightmare this is going to be if they don't narrowly confine what they mean by intergovernmental agreement.
And who bears, the responsibility for this? I mean, Rick McIver seems to be the point man here as the municipal affairs minister, but a lot of this goes well beyond municipal affairs.
Right. So, I mean, one option, if they confined it to municipalities, would be to have the Minister of Municipal Affairs vet all of these agreements and sign off on them. But now the universities are involved. The Advanced Education Minister would be responsible for all of those. I don't know. That spreads out the vetting, certainly across government, but it also spreads out the expertise. And that makes it more difficult to coordinate, between ministries to have a full intergovernmental strategy that's coherent, which is part of the goal of this exercise. So, I hope that some of that kind of forethought went into this, but I was not overly impressed by the premier and the minister's comments that suggest that this process is going to be easier than not. It's going to be very complex.
Now, the underlying principles aren't necessarily partisan. I mean, governments come and go, but I think these ideas can transcend that. It's hard to separate the political realities from all of this, though, and the tensions between Alberta and Ottawa. Would this look different, if we have or maybe will have at some point a different government in Ottawa, for example? What about those dynamics and how that affects all of this?
Yeah, I mean, what this is designed to do, in the premier's own words, is to stop the federal government from using the federal spending power, which is its ability to spend on anything it wants, including in areas of provincial jurisdiction. And in that sense, it's not anything particular new. It's a new tool that is toward an end that lots of premiers in Alberta history have used. But I think a lot of people are mistaken if they think that the Liberal Party in Ottawa is the only one that is talking about intruding on areas of provincial jurisdiction. There's not a lot of daylight between the two housing plans of the two major parties, the Conservatives and Liberals, in terms of the amount of money that they'd be flowing into cities and the number of strings that would be attached to that funding.
Right.
So unless after the election, if Pierre Poilievre does pull out a victory like everyone expects, unless Danielle Smith says, we're going to put, the Sovereignty Act on pause, we're going to put this Alberta Priorities Act in abeyance for the time being because open federalism has returned, unless she does that, then the Pierre Poilievre Conservatives are going to be facing the same kind of struggles to get money to Alberta municipalities and public bodies that the Trudeau Liberals will.
We'll see how it all plays out. As mentioned, your analysis is up at drjaredwesley.substack.com. Dr. Wesley, thanks again for your insight on this and appreciate you making some time for us here.
Thanks for making time.
Okay, so there you go. Some interesting perspective from Dr. Jared Wesley, professor of political science, University of Alberta. The principle of the idea, there's some merit to it. I think what he's saying is there's going to be a lot more to it maybe than the province realizes or is letting on. But if it needs to be done, it needs to be done. And I mean, other provinces do this, not all. I don't think Ontario has anything like this in place. And there was, recent announcement or a deal to provide Toronto with some housing dollars. But it is true that what Pierre Poilievre has talked about, and I mean, the Conservatives accused the Liberals of stealing their idea, more funding directly to cities, a building bonus to cities that allow more construction. That would certainly complicate all of this. I guess, you know, the catch here is that so long as the province approves of these deals, so maybe the province will be in more of an approving mood if there's a different government in Ottawa, perhaps. There was a time, not too long ago, when there were many who expressed very publicly doubts that we needed a public inquiry into the whole issue of foreign election interference, or specifically Chinese foreign interference. I don't know that anyone can credibly argue that now, but we certainly heard it, including from the federal government, from the prime minister, from the special rapporteur appointed by the prime minister, David Johnston, who had access to all of the intelligence and yet concluded that we didn't need a public inquiry. But the public pressure became too difficult to ignore. And we got a public inquiry, and thank goodness that we did. I think some of the revelations that have emerged, the very intelligence that David Johnston saw and concluded that maybe the rest of us didn't need to see, well, it certainly demolished his credibility, I think, unfortunately, but it's underscored the importance of addressing these matters in this form. The extent to which China was trying to interfere in our democratic processes, the level of concern that exists on the part of Canada's intelligence community, the information that was being presented to the government, the warnings that were being presented to government, and then, of course, the question as to what, if anything, the government did about it. Now, certainly we've learned a lot about the warnings that didn't come from government to those who maybe needed to hear them, or the steps that weren't taken to address all of this. Now, we've heard from numerous government officials, cabinet ministers. It was the prime minister's opportunity yesterday to testify before the inquiry. And I think part of the rationale or the excuse he tried to give was that he wasn't necessarily convinced that the warnings or the intelligence gathered by CSIS were complete. The question was put to him today that if, you know, you were so inclined to push back on everything CSIS was bringing to you, what kind of a message does that send about your own confidence in the intelligence community?
I have, of course, tremendous confidence in the extraordinary women and men who serve in our national security institutions. It is extremely important work that's getting more and more difficult every day. But no government, no leader should simply be a passive receiver of information and intelligence. We have a role to play in asking questions, on thinking critically, on encouraging further work, on questioning sources and pulling out contradictions. That actually is part and parcel of the work that we all need to do to make sure that everything is done to keep Canadians safe. It is a very active role that we play in constant conversation with our top intelligence officials as they make decisions around what it is that is credible and pertinent to share with us. And we will continue to listen very closely, very carefully to everything they put forward and make sure that we are all doing everything necessary to keep Canadians safe.
Well, joining us for more on the Prime Minister's testimony, what else this public inquiry has delivered, is Sam Cooper. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, founder of The Bureau, previously with Global News, and was part of breaking some really big stories on this issue a couple of years ago that led us to this inquiry. So much more at thebureau.news. Sam Cooper, so great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Rob.
We'll start with the Prime Minister's testimony. I think some interesting questions put to the Prime Minister and maybe some revealing answers or non-answers in some cases. First of all, what did you make of the Prime Minister's appearance?
Well, overall, I found him, as always, very, you know, practiced, eloquent, and passionate in some of his speech-making and themes. I thought the very key revelation yesterday was that for the first time, we heard the Prime Minister give a detailed answer that he was briefed in late September 2019, specifically regarding CSIS and election monitor security officials' concerns with a Toronto area riding involving Trudeau's MP nominee, Han Don. And we heard that Mr. Trudeau was warned by his senior political aide that CSIS had concerns that Mr. Don, the nominee, benefited from students that were directed to vote in his nomination earlier in that September, and that they were directed by allegedly Chinese officials in Toronto. And so to end my answer here, really a bombshell revelation that Mr. Trudeau knew. So Canadians knew those allegations, and he told Canadians he was aware. He felt that the information merited follow-up, and certainly the consideration that CSIS had concerns, potentially well-grounded suspicions, but Mr. Trudeau said he didn't believe the information met the high bar of removing Mr. Don, who had won that nomination in Don Valley North. So for me, that was really the essence of what was revealed in the testimony. And additionally, to end my answer here, a lot of documents were produced showing that Mr. Trudeau and his top aides were briefed many times on Chinese election interference. But in a nutshell, Mr. Trudeau's answers were, these are briefing notes, and he didn't necessarily hear the printed words that those documents showed.
Well, and this is important, right? Because I think one of the questions all along has been, you know, to what extent was the prime minister in the dark about all of this? Did it work, all this information or these briefings work their way up to him? Or was he aware and simply chose not to take steps? And so the picture's emerging here that it's really more the latter, isn't it?
I think that's accurate. Again, especially the very key case here. Most of the testimony has been on allegations in the Toronto ridings in 2019, specifically in that Don Valley North riding. And we have heard and seen the documents. Mr. Trudeau and his top aides were told CSIS believed Chinese officials directed people to vote for Mr. Don. And so Mr. Trudeau essentially answered, if true, that certainly would be foreign interference. So that establishes, yes, he knew something about that very key case. And yet the key thing here that I took away from his testimony and his other key ministers, including former Public Safety Minister Bill Blair, is that they admitted, yes, these documents you're presenting to us, commission lawyers, show we were briefed on Chinese interference in 2019 and 2021, but consistently these ministers, including Mr. Trudeau, answered, we got high-level briefings, but we knew none of these allegations that China funded candidates or networks related to allegedly pro-Beijing politicians. We didn't know those details until after media reports. That's their story, and they're sticking to it, is what I took away.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've reported extensively on the whole Handong situation, both in terms of his nomination battle and what went on there, and even, of course, you know, his conversation with top officials at the Chinese consulate in Toronto. Both of these have been a focus at the inquiry, and I think we've learned a lot on both of these stories, much of which vindicates, I would argue, your original reporting. What has stood out to you so far?
Certainly, it was very, I would say, a key public interest story to interrogate the allegations, to examine what confidential intelligence sources informed Global News that allegedly Mr. Don privately called a senior Chinese official in February 2021 and raised a number of political issues, including the cases of the Michaels detained in China and Meng Wanzhou. And as you know, the Liberal Party, including the Prime Minister and Mr. Don, pushed back very strongly on the allegations we reported that Mr. Don allegedly advised the Chinese official that immediately releasing the Michaels would benefit the opposition conservatives. And yet, as we reported, the alleged conversation was that Mr. Don said China, however, needed to show some progression in the cases because that would be helpful. And so this is the thrust of what we reported. The allegations are in that conversation, Mr. Don raised the cases and how China could proceed in a way that could be good for the Liberal Party and would not help the Conservative Party. And from what I saw of the evidence tabled in the commission, that is what came out in a summary document. I want to be very careful and state very clearly, Mr. Don and a number of people, including his lawyers, maintain he did not say those words. and continue to deny any wrongdoing. But if you ask me, did the evidence come out supporting Global News' reporting, I'm saying yes.
As for the, you know, the broader question about 2019 election and the 2021 election, and, you know, questions put to the Prime Minister again, you know, to what extent were you aware of interference attempts, what was done? I mean, we've heard from the Conservatives, you know, the other parties, they were completely in the dark, right? So what do we know about whether any kind of warnings or intelligence was being shared with the other parties and certainly the Conservatives especially?
Well, that's the other key, huge piece of this testimony. As you know, we have Western MPs, former MPs, including Kenny Chu, who the evidence is incontrovertible, undeniable. CSIS election monitors appointed by the Trudeau government in 2019, 2021, they knew, and documents show they knew, that Mr. Chu was attacked on Chinese communist-controlled social media in Canada, specifically because Mr. Chu had suggested a measure to protect Canada's democracy that would provide transparency on anyone acting for foreign governments, not China, mind you, any foreign government. Mr. Chu was attacked. Mr. Chu believes that contributed to his loss. What has come out in the hearing is that, you know, Chinese social media is highly controlled, and as is much of the Chinese ethnic media in Canada by Beijing. So not only Mr. Chu, Mr. O'Toole was attacked very directly in connection to both Canadian media and Chinese-controlled media. Again, it was we've seen the evidence again and again. Mr. O'Toole was attacked as a Trump-like anti-Chinese someone involved in racial animus against Chinese Canadians, which was absolutely false and twisted. And these Mr. O'Toole testified. These attacks hurt him and quite possibly led to, you know, his not only he's saying very clear here, the Conservatives probably didn't lose, but the election, because of this, they believe they lost seats. But certainly Mr. O'Toole believes he lost potentially his leadership of that party, specifically in relation to those attacks. Now, the key here to get to my answer, look, Trudeau's panel of election monitors knew very deeply and clearly these partisan attacks were going against the Conservatives. Meanwhile, none of these attacks were going against the Liberal Party, and these bureaucrats chose not to intervene publicly, which would be a big move. But beyond that, they didn't even tell Mr. Chu or Mr. O'Toole or other people that they were being attacked. And maybe we can help you, you know that we believe something nefarious is happening. So that's my answer. The evidence, I believe, that's come out is the commission lawyers want to know, did the Liberal Party benefit from the actions of the inactions of election monitors?
So the inquiry is not sitting today, but it's shaping up maybe to be an interesting day tomorrow with the CSIS director returning. What are you watching for?
That's right. This is a huge story that the Bureau has covered in this inquiry, and I believe very important. The key here is that CSIS's director, David Vigneault, took the very rare step of revising intelligence reporting, again, related to Han Dong's alleged benefiting from people directed by China in that Don Valley North riding, of which we've said Mr. Trudeau was also warned of prior to the 2019 election. David Vigneault, the director of Canada's intelligence service, changed CSIS's intelligence twice. Not once, but twice. He changed it in 2019 after talking with Prime Minister Trudeau's national security advisor, probably the most powerful official in Canadian security. And again, when Mr. Trudeau met with the CSIS director in early 2023, David Vigneault changed the Han Dong intelligence in ways we don't understand yet. So David Vigneault, a document was produced after his initial testimony. Commission lawyers said, we need to talk to David Vigneault again about this document, which reflects his meeting with Prime Minister Trudeau on the Han Dong story, media leaks and intelligence. And so Mr. Vigneault will be asked about that document again tomorrow. And I believe he'll also be asked Is it true what Mr. Trudeau, that is Prime Minister Trudeau, and his top aides are saying? All of these documents that the commission has seen about David Vigneault and CFIUS telling them about Chinese threats don't really reflect what was verbally said. So, of course, Mr. Vigneault will have to ask, what did he actually tell Prime Minister and his top aides?
Should be interesting. Much more on all of this, thebureau.news. Sam Cooper, really appreciate the insight on all this. Thanks so much for making some time for us here.
Thanks, Rob.
We've been talking a lot about the carbon tax lately. Of course, the carbon tax, federal carbon tax rate went up on April 1st. Of course, the federal government argues that the rebates went up too. And even just recently, they've topped up the rural portion of the rebate. But doing so came at the expense of small business. And there's another component to the carbon tax I think we need to focus on is how this affects small business. Now, today, Alberta's Environment Minister Rebecca Schultz posted a video calling on her federal counterpart to take some steps to ensure that there's fairness here and support for small business. And this concerns one aspect of the whole carbon tax picture, what's known as the Fuel Charge Proceeds Return Program, money that the federal government promised would go back to small businesses but hasn't.
In Alberta alone, this amounts to $718 million that Justin Trudeau and Stephen Guilbeault have taken out of the pockets of small businesses. The Canadian Federation of Independent Business has pointed out that if these carbon tax dollars were returned to the 175,000 businesses in Alberta, each business would receive $4,000. That's money that could be used to make payroll and keep the lights on. And to make matters even worse, before returning even a cent to businesses, Stephen Guilbeault has announced that they are cutting the rebates that will be available in the future. Stephen Guilbeault has no idea what he is doing, and small businesses across our country are paying the price. The federal government needs to stop the bleeding, cancel the planned cut, and return the $2.5 billion owed to small businesses that they have been holding hostage for the past 5 years.
Now, the Canadian Federation of Independent Business has been pleading with the federal government to do this. And looking ahead to the budget next week and the priorities outlined for small businesses, this is top of the list. Return this $2.5 billion in carbon tax revenue. Now, they have some other ideas on what could be useful and helpful to small businesses, like lowering the federal small business tax rate, increasing the small business deduction threshold, those kinds of steps. Reducing red tape would certainly help. But this is a big one. So joining us to talk a bit more about, you know, this whole situation and how, you know, this the federal government came to be sitting on this big pile of carbon tax revenue. Very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Andrew Senya, Provincial Affairs Director for Alberta with the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, CFIB.ca. Andrew, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So explain how all of this works then. What it is that the small businesses are paying related to the carbon tax or the fuel charge proceeds return program, I guess, which is supposed to return that money to small businesses.
Certainly. So obviously, we need to go back a little bit and take our minds back to 2019 when the federal government introduced the federal backstop program. Obviously, in 2019, we had the election of the United Conservative government that repealed the carbon tax, and subsequently, the federal backstop program was imposed in Alberta beginning in 2020. So what we have had over the past, you know, 4 years, essentially that small businesses have been paying the carbon tax with the expectation of a rebate. And right now in Ottawa, there is approximately $718 million that small businesses have paid and are entitled to that haven't been returned.
And why hasn't it been returned then? If it was promised, what's going on?
Rob, that is the $718 million question that Alberta small businesses have for the federal government, and the $2.5 billion question that, you know, those in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario have for the federal government. And I wish I had an answer for you.
So in the meantime, then, what does that mean for small businesses?
Well, I mean, let's, you know, the economic challenges, you know, that exist not only for consumers, you know, exist for small businesses. We've seen, you know, with the federal carbon tax rising to $65, that means, you know, higher utility costs. You know, businesses in Alberta have cited utility costs as their top cost constraint. You're seeing changing consumer patterns. Businesses are struggling, Rob, and there's no easy way to put it. And, you know, this $4,000 that is owed to small business would be great in order to, you know, to contribute in some way to paying their payroll. You know, we've spoken, you know, earlier this year and talked about SEBA. Some of the businesses owe SEBA loans, you know, to repay those loans and to repay a portion of that.
So inevitably then, you know, these costs, and I think when people talk about the impact of the carbon tax, what consumers end up paying, you know, businesses need to absorb these costs. That becomes part of the indirect cost to Canadians with the carbon tax, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. And for many of our members, when we surveyed them late last year, you know, most of them said we can't pass it off to consumers because then they, you know, then people are not going to visit their store. And that's just not fair to businesses who are now, you know, forced to pay these costs and are unable to pass it on. And again, we're looking at, you know, for example, all across the province, you're seeing property taxes go up. We're seeing, you know, energy costs go up. Their insurance costs are going up. There's just a lot of costs associated, you know, for small businesses.
And, you know, look, I mean, the rebates that were promised haven't been delivered, but moving forward now looks as though whatever rebates eventually do come the way of small businesses, whenever that is, that's going to be lower. So the federal government recently topped up the rural portion of the rebate, which is all fine, but they did so at the expense of small business, right? This rebate side, the rebate side for small business was cut back.
Yeah, certainly. So when the program was originally announced, 9% was to go to small businesses, and the rest to the rural and Indigenous groups. That number has now gone down to 5, and you've seen the top up for Indigenous and rural Albertans and Canadians. But, you know, we take no umbrage with that. The issue at hand is to return the money. So it's $2.5 billion that has been collected and sitting somewhere in Ottawa for the past 4 years. You know, that's the number that's owed to the four provinces, 718 that's owed to Alberta businesses. And that's that key number that we're calling on the federal government to return. Now, I think it's also important that we recognize that we've moved into a new fiscal year. Mm-hmm. And right now there is, you know, $3.1 billion, if you include this year's, the new numbers and the updated numbers. And that includes, so that would be about $877 million that is owed to Alberta businesses by the end of 2025.
So the federal finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, recently addressed this. And I mean, at least what you heard, I would imagine, was encouraging, the idea that Ottawa is committed to returning this money. But, you know, as they say about something about actions speaking louder than words, I think.
Yeah, certainly. And the deputy prime minister, to her credit, said that, you know, there's some good news coming. What that news is, I guess we will find out on the 16th. But in the previous communication from the federal government, it's going to, you know, specifically the rebates are being allocated to emission-intensive and trade-exposed industries. Now, what that means, we don't really understand, because as far as we're concerned, the carbon tax in its conception and application is meant to be revenue neutral. And if it is revenue neutral and 90%, the revenue returned to the jurisdiction in which it was taxed, you know, all businesses pay into it, yet they're not, you know, most businesses will be excluded from it if we go by this definition of emissions intensive and trade exposed. And again, our calculations also demonstrate that businesses pay approximately, you know, in the collection of the carbon tax, 40% of those revenues. So again, if you were to rebate what businesses are owed, that number becomes exponentially larger.
So an opportunity next week, I guess, for the federal government to finally deliver on this promise, maybe other ways in which they could help small businesses. What are you looking for, hoping to see in next week's federal budget?
Well, what we would like to see is, you know, the return of this funds immediately, the $2.5 billion and the 718 to Alberta businesses. That's what we are asking for. And that is, you know, to all businesses in Alberta, that's the main thing that we're looking for. But again, it's the call that we've had for the provincial, the municipal, and yes, the federal government, it's to not increase the cost of doing business. You know, the same economic challenges that consumers are facing are the same challenges that businesses are facing. So again, the call to all levels of government is to not increase any cost and to help small businesses and provide, in many respects, cost relief.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens in the budget next week. In the meantime, much more on these issues. There's also a petition that you guys have. It's at cfib.ca. So people want to read more about that issue. It's all there. Andrew, thanks so much for making some time for us here today. Appreciate this.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Rob.
All the best. Take care. Andrew Senya is Provincial Affairs Director for Alberta with the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. So an interesting aspect to this whole carbon tax debate, and federal government said all along they were going to return this money. The finance minister said just recently they were going to return this money. So we'll just do it then. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.